Ladies and gentlemen,
today in Studio 360,
the Beatles.
Exactly 50 years ago, the Beatles arrived in America.
I was crazy about them. The Beatles were all you talked about, all you cared about. Close your eyes
and I kiss you. So what are today's crazy teenagers going that crazy over?
On a scale of 1 to 10, where would you place yourselves as Justin Bieber fans?
It's just infinite, like infinite times infinite amounts of infinity.
Bieber mania explained. Plus, I'll talk with a musician who's following in the Beatles' footsteps, pushing at the edges of what a rock tune can sound like.
I've always tried to live at that intersection between accessible pop music and lunatic fringe music.
Annie Clark, also known as St. Vincent. I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead in this hour of Studio 360, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Middlemarch is one of those novels that if you haven't read it, seems like, yeah, guess I should have read it. I'll talk with the ultimate fan who might convince you to pick it up and do it. I'll also talk with the musician St. Vincent about her new album called St. Vincent. But first, every 4 years, I rediscover that figure skaters are amazing athletes and that the music they use to accompany their performances is, in my opinion, not quite so amazing. Even as competitive figure skating continues to push the boundaries of what's possible physically, almost all of the music remains the same. So how come? Why does the one sport that incorporates music seem stuck in such a rut musically? Joining me to talk about this is the reporter Katie Baker of Grantland, who is in Sochi right now. Katie, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So it's consistently classical music in figure skating in this pretty narrow range of the 19th century romantic. You're Rossini, you're Johann Strauss, all the Russians, Tchaikovsky, Rimsky-Korsakov, Rachmaninoff, and occasionally some movie soundtrack music by John Williams. Why is there such a restricted and familiar range?
Well, I think we're seeing that figure skating is still a sport in which the judges and the old school federation folks continue to wield considerable power. And part of that manifests itself in the music choices. I think people would rather do something that's relatively safe.
So is it that, do we think that the Olympics are more conservative, more international, more high stakes, and therefore better just to go with Tchaikovsky?
Yeah, and I mean, especially being in Russia, I think some of the skaters realize that they can get the crowd behind them a little more, maybe kiss up a little bit.
Uh-huh.
I think Gracie Gold is one who basically came out and admitted that. She's skating to, I think, Sleeping Beauty. So, but then you do see people here and there who are willing to push the buttons a little bit. There's an ice dance team that the U.S. has, brother and sister, called the Shib Sibs. And they do their free skate to Jackson medley that includes Thriller. And it's such a fun skate, but more importantly, it really matches the way they skate. I think if you tried to put maybe, you know, a tiny little Russian ballerina out there to Thriller, it wouldn't work at all. So I think that's another consideration.
Right.
That said, there's hope for the future in that going forward, actually starting after the Olympics, so starting in the 2014-2015 season, skaters will now be allowed to use songs that have words that are being sung instead of just,
yeah.
Even if they do choose a pop song right now, it's usually like a symphony arrangement of it.
Which is all.
So I think that'll be a really interesting step.
Yeah. And those symphonic Mantovani-esque arrangements of popular music are even worse, in my personal opinion.
They are. I mean, sometimes they're just comical. Like the other night during the team competition, there was a guy I can't remember if it was a pairs or a single, but they were skating to November Rain.
The Guns N' Roses song.
You know, with like a lone violin playing. You know, I wish they could just skate to the actual song if they're going to skate to it.
Yeah.
So I agree.
Yeah. So last weekend, Ashley Wagner did her figure skating to this Pink Floyd song, Shine On You Crazy Diamond. Now, to me, that record was cheesy when I heard it in the 1970s. And also, why not use something from pop music of her generation?
She likes to describe herself as very feisty and fierce, and I think she thinks, or I think her idea is that the song really can allow her to show that side of her. But again, I mean, I'm actually really excited to see, I know I keep coming back to the Thriller thing, but that to me is a way where you can really bridge this wanting to appeal to an international audience. Everyone loves Thriller. You know, if people were to find some good Beatles tunes, it would be a total crowd hit around the world. So I think even when we do move into a bigger range of songs with lyrics, we're probably still going to get sick of some of the same old selections. Almost like going to a wedding and the DJ always plays Brick House.
I wonder if part of it is because perhaps there is this inferiority complex that figure skaters have against, you know, the serious athletes, that they want to stick to serious 19th century classical music because if they suddenly go pop, people will take them less seriously?
It's possible, but it's funny because depending on who the skater is, when they go to, you know, international sort of just exhibition events, they do really fun events. I mean, Johnny Ware, years ago, used to skate to Poker Face. And then Yevgeny Plushenko has a famous routine that he performed to Sex Bomb and took his shirt off and had like a fake muscle shirt on underneath.
Wow.
So they have that in them.
Is there, I mean, can you imagine a song or a piece of music beyond Michael Jackson's Thriller, which you clearly love, that you would love to see somebody to skate to?
This is funny, and this is not a great answer, but I was thinking earlier, when they do relax the restrictions on allowing vocals, I was trying to think about what some of the more popular songs might be. And for some reason, the song Hero by Mariah Carey was in my head, and I could just imagine some woman doing a routine to Hero by Mariah Carey. I don't know why.
Yep. Did you happen to see this? You're there, so you don't need to rely on the internet, but did you see this viral video that somebody did of Merrill Davis and Charlie White's routine where they stripped out the Rimsky-Korsakov that they actually performed to and replaced it with the Beyoncé song Drunk in Love?
No, I didn't see that one. I saw the one with Plushenko skating to Genuine's Pony, which was the one I said where he skated to Sex Bomb.
Yeah.
They dubbed one ridiculous song over another, and it is the funniest. I was laughing out loud at 2 a.m. last night, Russia time, watching the video. But I did see that they had that a website had reader suggestions, and they paired various routines. It's really fun to watch.
Check out the Merrill Davis and Charlie White to Beyonce. It's perfect. Katie, thank you so much, and enjoy the rest of your stay. I hope your room is better than the rooms I've read about.
It's good. I've only had one shower rod fall on my head, so I'm all good.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kurt. I really appreciate it.
Katie Baker is a reporter for Grantland, and she is in Sochi covering the Olympic Games. So, what do you all think? If you were a figure skater, what music would you want to perform to? Me? I'm thinking Talking Heads. Leave us a comment at studio360.org. I've got some good news and some bad news, and let's do the bad first. You've only got 2 weeks left to submit to our latest listener challenge.
Well, there's still time, I beg you.
The good news is that we're only asking you to make 30-second-long horror movies, so it really shouldn't take you that long. We've got some great submissions so far, including an animated short of a melting drummer. A young baby genius who really prefers mom to dad.
Mama. Nice.
And Gray Matter, a horror thriller about aliens stealing our planet's most intelligent minds. Literally, just their brains. They're extracted with a laser. This super short has a cameo by our 40th president.
I couldn't help but say to him, just think how easy his task and mine might be in these meetings that we held if suddenly there was a threat to this world from some other species, from another planet, outside in the universe. We'd forget all the little local differences that we have between our countries, and we would find out once and for all that we really are all human beings here on this earth together.
Gray Matter is the work of Tim Thomas of Lynchburg, Virginia.
The idea for the film came from a dream that my wife had. She woke up in the middle of the night, and there was a light coming from outside the window, and it was obviously extraterrestrial. I think anybody who's ever YouTubed, binged, you get to some video and you're not quite sure how you got there. Eventually, I got to one where the headline was, President Reagan warns us of the alien agenda. And so I put it on, and I see this very bizarre speech, almost as if our former late president was narrating, you know, my little opus.
And yet, I ask you, is not an alien force already among us?
Our judge, Wes Craven, will choose the winner of our Scary Short Film Fest next month. Your deadline is Oscar night, March 2nd. Remember, the theme is young genius. If you need some more inspiration, you can check out our very own Down and Dirty 30-Second Movie at studio360.org. Spoiler alert, it's my own private nightmare.
Hashtag Scary Shorts.
Studio 360. Coming up next, no new rock artist of the last few years has gotten more love from critics and fans than St. Vincent. And she'll be right here momentarily talking about her latest album.
The hardest thing for any musician to do is to sound like yourself. And I thought, you know what, I sound like myself on this record, so I just self-titled it.
When you're calling, to you.
You're listening to Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. David Byrne chose her to collaborate with him on an album.
Lazarus, what I want to do deep was the state.
The Smithsonian gave her an American Ingenuity Award for, quote, having a revolutionary effect on how we perceive the world and how we live. Her last record, Strange Mercy, appeared on pretty much every best of list. If there's such a thing as American indie rock royalty, Annie Clark, who performs as St. Vincent, is definitely a member. Those of us who are besotted love her music's contradictions. It sounds like pop, but also tends toward the strange and dark.
Forgive the kids, for they don't know how to live. Run the alleys, casually, crew.
Her fourth album, St. Vincent, is out this month, and she is here with me now, Annie Clark. Welcome to Studio 360.
Hello. Thank you.
So, since you became a solo performer 6 or 7 years ago, you have performed as St. Vincent, and now your fourth record is called St. Vincent. I've always been curious about bands that do that. I think of Velvet Underground's third record called The Velvet Underground. Is this the most St. Vincent-ish record?
You know, I was reading Miles Davis's autobiography, and in it he talks about how the hardest thing for any musician to do is to sound like yourself. And I thought, you know what, I sound like myself on this record, so I just self-titled it.
So the fact that on first hearing I loved this the most of any of your records, does that seem correct?
That seems correct.
Am I correct in having that reaction?
Yes, you, as a matter of fact, yes. No, I think I like it the most.
And other than it becoming yourself, what does that mean and why do you like it the best? Just because you figured out how to do it after a few?
Well, I don't know. I think that it's I've always tried to live at that intersection between accessible pop music, if you will, and lunatic fringe music. And I think that this one is – I got the proper balance right on this one.
Yeah. So when you make up a stage name, is that mostly a marketing decision or I want to keep the public me different than the personal me or what?
You know, I think originally – because it's been years now since I made that decision. I was a wee lass. I mean, at the time, I just thought it was a – it seemed like a container in which I could put all my art.
Right.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah,
and it wasn't so much about creating a persona or hiding. It was just, okay, well, Annie Clark sounds – to be frank, very, very boring.
Yeah.
So I'm going to call myself something else.
Or like a country singer.
Yeah, exactly. Christian contemporary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
that's my next career.
Go for it. Yeah. Let's listen to the first single off this new album, St. Vincent. It's called Birth in Reverse. That is St. Vincent singing Birth in Reverse, which gets to what you just said of being poppy and accessible and slightly lunatic.
Thank you.
it also sounds like there it was the defiant, frustrated response to something. Is that how that was came to be?
Well, you know, I made Strange Mercy, which was my last solo record, which was a record that was, to be quite frank, about a lot of pain, external, internal. And so during the tour for Strange Mercy, which is a slightly more subdued record,
yeah,
I started stage diving and just to kind of elevate the show to – I just wanted to really feel something. And I didn't care if that meant pain, but I wanted to really feel
How
it.
How punk.
So punk. And – then I went straight from that tour into a tour with David Byrne, which was so fun and very choreographed. And then I went straight from that into writing this record. And so I think I brought kind of – I brought the viscera of the Strange Mercy live show, but then the danceability of the Byrne show into the songs that I was writing. It just happened very naturally.
A perfect pop music dialectic. And it also – one of the reasons I like it so much is it kind of rocks harder by a notch or two than your previous albums, like on Psychopath and on this song, which I want to play a little bit of, called Bring Me Your Loves.
Bring me your loves, all your loves, your loves. I want to love them too, you know. Bring me your loves, all your loves, your loves. I want to love them too, you know. Bring me your loves, all your loves, your loves. I want to love them too, you know. Thought you were like a dog. I thought you were like a dog.
Yeah, Bring Me Your Loves. I was listening to Turkish psych music from the 70s and Pantera.
You are the hipster-ish hipster I've ever spoken to.
I am not being a hipster. I grew up in Dallas, Texas.
I know.
And what was hip as a suburban kid was Pantera, Metallica, Megadeth, Maiden. Love that stuff.
But in general, there it does seem like the feeling of this is cheerful, unselfconscious rock and roll-y for all of its normal, beloved St. Vincent weirdness.
Well, I'm glad you think so. I certainly enjoy it.
Good. You, as you mentioned, are coming off this major collaboration with David Byrne. You made a couple of records with him. I've loved his music from the beginning. I've loved your music from the beginning. But I never would have thought, oh, those two should go do music together. You see, your previous music seemed more kind of romantic and mid-century cabaret-ish and all that. Then as soon as you did it, I thought, oh, yeah, that kind of makes sense. They're both poppy and lunatic, right?
Well, I just have to say that I loved getting to work with David. It was, I would say it was a dream come true, except I probably would never even have dreamed mm-hmm. that I would get to make a record with David Byrne. I think the collaboration worked well because he can bring out that kind of elation, that ecstatic, crazed elation, and then I tend toward the more melancholic. And I think we met somewhere in the uh-huh. middle, and I think it worked well.
Let's listen to something from that you did together. What should we listen to?
I always liked I Should Watch TV. That's bananas.
Which also sounds like a – it could be a St. Vincent song title. It also sounds like a Talking Heads song title.
Absolutely.
But let's listen to it.
I used to think that I should watch TV. I used to think that it was good for me.
That is St. Vincent with David Byrne from their album Love This Giant. Did you write together, or was it just batting things back and forth and editing each other?
Well, that song in particular, I remember I had that, you know, that thing, and it was this really mm-hmm. kind of ornate guitar thing that I sent David, and he wrote the melody over it and came up with the words and added another section. And I remember there was a section that he couldn't quite transcribe exactly. So he just went on the keyboard, just kind of wiggled his fingers. And that's what you hear.
That became the thing.
The high trumpet part is kind of him interpreting my part in a really silly way.
One of those serendipitous accidents.
Absolutely.
That becomes part of art. You're from Dallas.
I am.
You got your start sort of in Polyphonic Spree, this huge one-of-a-kind psychedelic-ish band based there. Absent that experience, would you have been on a different path musically, or are you and that was just a thing you did?
I would always be making records, I think. I would always be making my own music. That was certainly a pivotal experience and a really, really fun one, and one I look back on with a lot of fondness, because I was like, I was a kid, and
yeah.
I wasn't suddenly,
like the Musketeers.
Yeah, I was suddenly in a rock band, and there was Jägermeister and not showering, and it was just a really, which sounds disgusting to
both
me
of
now.
Them.
Yeah, but at the time, it was just like, oh my God, I'm on the road.
Right.
I'm opening for Brian Wilson. You know, so fun.
Learning the theremin.
Yeah, well, I'm no Clara Rockmore, but I do what I can.
But did it change you musically, other than just being this, like, coming-of-age thing?
I think, yeah. I mean, I think that I played guitar in the Polyphonic Spree, and Tim, the singer, would come up. And before I played guitar in the Polyphonic Spree, I was kind of more of like a finger-style, kind of a cleaner guitar player.
But a guitar player, listeners who don't know, is what you all began as and are.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been playing for 20 years. But Tim would come over and he'd go, hey, can you make that sparkly? And I'd be like, yeah. And I'd, you know, run to Guitar Center and buy whatever pedal I thought might make a sparkly sound and come back. And so that's when I started really experimenting with guitar effects and started cultivating the my sound.
You write a lot of songs from the perspectives of characters. I want to play a little bit of a song from this new album called Severed Crossed Fingers. Now, is that a character, or is that you venting? And in your songs, generally, are there clear distinctions between those two?
Oh, that one's all me.
Yeah? Well, when there's a person, and then there's a stage name, and then there are sometimes characters one doesn't know, necessarily.
You know, I think maybe I've made a little bit too much of the idea that I'm singing this song from different characters.
Right, right.
I mean, in some ways, I think about those things in terms of like a vocal approach,
right.
And different archetypes kind of emerge in different records.
Right.
Like the last record I did, Strange Mercy, was the archetype of like a repressed housewife on barbiturates and white wine. And, you know, this one is a different archetype, near future cult leader. And, but it's all incredibly personal. I mean, it's all very much me.
Yeah. That's well put. And it's in fact, maybe the best put of the blurry line between art and the artist that I've heard. Near future cult leader?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of references to cults like the Heaven's Gate situation, the Hale Bopp Comet. I'm a fan of cults.
A student of cults.
I'm a student of cults.
Yeah. Well, and you're from Dallas.
Yeah.
Nothing against Dallas. we could go on all day and all night, but we are out of time. You mentioned Pantera earlier. If there's one Pantera song that you can name, we can, for the first time on public radio, play a Pantera song.
Really?
As we go out. That can be our farewell contribution to the public radio canon.
Okay. Cowboys from Hell. Duh.
Excellent. Annie Clark, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Annie Clark's new album, As St. Vincent, is called St. Vincent, and it's out later this month. Still ahead in Studio 360, everybody knows that sound of shrieking 50 years ago for the band that got bigger than Jesus. Do any young crowds get that hysterical these days? Believers do.
I love Justin since 2009.
My whole life dedicated. It's just, it's all I think about.
That's right. It's Bieber versus the Beatles, just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
And now, here he is, Ed Sullivan.
Now, yesterday and today, our theater's been jammed with newspapermen and hundreds of photographers from all over the nation, and these veterans agree with me that the city never has witnessed the excitement stirred by these youngsters from Liverpool who call themselves the Beatles. Now, tonight, you're going to twice be entertained by them. Right now and again in the second half of our show, ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I remember that Sunday night, 50 Februarys ago. Close your eyes, and I'll kiss you tomorrow. I was 9 years old watching The Ed Sullivan Show on a black and white TV with my brother and sisters and parents and grandparents. We'd all heard about the Beatles, and now they were making their American debut live. And 73 million of our fellow citizens, 40% of the population, were watching along with us. Sure, there had been girls screaming for Frank Sinatra 20 years earlier and for Elvis in the 50s, but Beatlemania was more, a couple of orders of magnitude bigger, one of the opening moments of the 60s as we came to know them. That mania is still circulating a bit through the culture. We sent Paul Vandekar out to sample it.
If you want to talk to some of the kids who went berserk over the Beatles, the first-generation Beatlemaniacs, you can find some at the B.B. King Blues Club in Times Square. That's where a Beatles tribute band called Strawberry Fields plays a brunch gig on Saturdays. Well, she was just 17, you know. These are the grandmothers and grandfathers who watched that Ed Sullivan Show broadcast and will never forget it.
They came out and introduced the Beatles, and from that minute, the screaming started, and the bouncing up and down, and the Beatles were wearing the suits, and the boots, and that adorable hair. The screaming was so loud, and everybody else was screaming, so I stood up on the chair and screamed for the rest of the show.
Girls screaming for them at the airport, girls breaking through the police lines at their hotel, girls chasing their car down the street.
Carrying the album around, pressed against my chest, and like every 3 minutes I would give Paul a kiss and tell him I loved him.
I mean, I loved their music, but I wasn't screaming, jumping up and down, anything like that until I saw the show.
Else, yeah.
And the girls were just absolutely out of their minds. And my very dear friend Vicky called me and said, "Which one do you love? Which one do you love?" And I'm like, "Oh, I really haven't thought about it." So it was that kind of thing,
yeah,
and it became infectious.
Yeah.
We had to declare our favorite Beatle immediately, and you had to have loyalty to that Beatle. My favorite Beatle was Ringo. He didn't really sing like the rest of them, so I always went for the guy that's always in the background. I love
you. After the Ed Sullivan Show appearance, Newsweek said musically they're a near disaster, guitars and drums slamming out a merciless beat. Their lyrics, punctuated by nutty shouts of yeah, 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 are a catastrophe, a preposterous farrago of Valentine card romantic sentiments. Parents hoped that the Beatles' star would fade like a dozen boy bands before them, but kids weren't paying attention to the squares.
The melodies and the words were so singable. You know, so we would literally get together on the playground and sing the songs, the harmonies, and the sort of the drum beat.
I was crazy about them. As I said, at this stage of my life, I can't imagine being that insane about something. I can't believe
it's happened to me. Across the street from the brunch gig, there's a movie theater. Earlier this winter, a new documentary opened there called Justin Bieber's Believe. The kids lined up to go in are known as Beliebers.
I'm 13. I've loved Justin since 2009.
Whole life dedicated. It's just, it's all you think, all I think about.
I brought paper bags to breathe in because sometimes it's hard. Or I brought a box of tissues. And I was handing them to people because people were crying.
On a scale of 1 to 10... where would you place yourselves as Justin Bieber fans?
10,000.
I don't have a number in there.
It's like broke my scale.
It's just infinite, like infinite times infinite amounts of infinity.
In Justin Bieber's Believe, there's footage of fans screaming for Justin, intercut with black and white footage of girls screaming for the Beatles.
I love how they're comparing that to him because he is just like them and he's so talented just like them. And I think the fans were just as dedicated to him as they were to them. And it's a good thing to be compared to.
In 1964, Paul and John were 22, 24. Justin Bieber is 19 and he hit it big 5 years ago.
Oh my God, look how close we are. Oh my God.
It all stemmed off from my fans showing up at each radio station. My fans posting video responses before I was signed. It all started from the fans, so it's got to end up with the fans.
I love it because that was so
And I don't think any of his bad boy outbursts are going to bother these fans.
When your family just annoys you, and you turn to Justin, and his beautiful angelic voice, you know, just calms you down. This kid really does know what's getting to us.
Baby, baby, oh, baby, baby, baby.
Well, be careful. Be careful.
The first few Beatle records were yeah, 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 and love me do, I love you, you know, be true and all that.
That's true.
No difference.
John Korba plays George Harrison in Strawberry Fields, the tribute band.
Every generation needs to have something they can call their own. We were calling rock and roll our own when our parents came up on big band. It's just the quality of the music that we were lucky enough to grow up to, you know, was really exceptional. Justin Bieber, who knows? I mean, I do know they're not going to be singing his songs in 20 or 30 years.
I mean, my mother screamed for Frank Sinatra, and she did. To me, it's hormonal, genetic, and just a function of mass culture.
A lot of people's actually been telling me lately, like, oh, when you get older, you're going to look back at this and be like, oh, you're so stupid for doing all of this stuff for a kid. Like, no, they don't realize that when I grow up and I'm older, I'm going to look back at all of this. I'm going to be like, I love the kid. I still love the kid. And I'm always going to be there for him. And I'm glad that I stuck through everything because it was so worth it. He's just amazing.
It's impossible for me to stop loving him. I will love him till I'm 80 years old.
I love him forever.
I'll make my kids love him. My great-grandchildren. We're all going to love him together.
My great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren.
No, I think we're just going to be Beatles fans for the...
Forever.
Forever.
Yeah. I'm going to have a play when I'm laid out in that little old coffin. I'm going to have Beatles music playing in the background.
For Studio 360... I'm Paul Vanderkar.
No hymns, just
no hymns,
just the Beatles.
Yeah, and Revolver especially. Revolver. That's my favorite album. She said, I know what it's like to be
dead. I know what it is to be sad. So what do you think? Will Justin Bieber ever make his Revolver or Sgt. Pepper? Will those kids who love him today still be singing along with his songs 50 years from now? Let us know what you think at studio360.org. Now let's back up another 100 years. In the middle of the 19th century in England, a writer named Marianne Evans was working away at serious, ambitious novels. And because they were so serious and ambitious, not ladylike, she didn't publish under her own name. She wrote as George Eliot. And now, a century and a half later, her novel Middlemarch is one of those great books you have to read if you want to be taken seriously as a reader. The main character of Middlemarch is a maybe too nice 19-year-old girl who marries a pedantic old bore. But the book is the chronicle of her whole town, the town of Middlemarch, her family and friends and neighbors. You can argue about whether it's the best 19th century novel in English, but it's definitely a contender. Rebecca Mead has just published a book called My Life in Middlemarch. It's partly literary biography and criticism, partly a memoir of the book's impact on her. As she told the New York Times...
You don't have to have read Middlemarch to read my book. You do have to have read Middlemarch to be a completely evolved human being. But everybody has a chance of doing that eventually.
I, of course, was exaggerating slightly. And I was trying to say that I didn't want people to feel intimidated about reading my book by feeling that they had an 800-page piece of homework that they had to get through before they read it. But I do think that Middlemarch can help you grow to be a wiser, more thoughtful person, and can also be a greatly pleasurable experience at the same time.
I want you to read a little bit of Middlemarch before I have you read any from your work. The sort of introduction, or at least what we're calling an introduction to Dorothea in the first chapter.
Her mind was theoretic and yearned by its nature after some lofty conception of the world which might frankly include the parish of Tipton and her own rule of conduct there. She was enamoured of intensity and greatness, and rash in embracing whatever seemed to her to have those aspects, likely to seek martyrdom, to make retractions, and then to incur martyrdom after all in a quarter where she had not sought it. Certainly such elements in the character of a marriageable girl tended to interfere with her lot and hinder it from being decided according to custom by good looks, vanity, and merely canine affection.
Oh, canine affection. That was Rebecca Mead reading from George Eliot's Middlemarch. It is a truth universally acknowledged that Middlemarch is one of the great novels of the last two centuries. Lots of people call it the best English novel of the last of ever. It's that and more to you, right? It's kind of a life manual.
Well, I first read it when I was 17, and I was completely seized by the story of this character, Dorothea. She's a young provincial woman yearning for a more significant life, and I was a young provincial woman yearning for a more significant life when I read it. And so it seized me, and it has continued to hold me through 30 or so years of rereading, and at different times of my life, it's expressed different things to me and made me recognize different things about my own life. So I would say it hasn't taught me how to live my life, but living my life has taught me how to read it better.
And has it changed your life? Let's say that, like so many other 17-year-olds, you had come upon and been gobsmacked by Siddhartha or a Kurt Vonnegut novel. Would you be a different person as a result?
Well, I think I would be a different person had I chosen a different novel. It was something about this book and the kind of seriousness of it, as well as the irony and the ambition of it, that spoke to me.
When it came out in pieces. It was serialized. How did people react to the pieces? Was it a success immediately?
It was a success immediately, yes. People were on tenterhooks waiting for the next installment. There are great stories of a bishop hiding a copy of it in his hat as he's at some religious convocation, dying to read it. And everybody was eager to read the next installment. It was like watching a serial on television.
Let's say Downton Abbey.
maybe not. You know, in terms of its seriousness and its ambition and its weaving, interweaving of stories, it's closer to something like The Wire, if not in content, in its aspirations.
Sure. Was it a milestone for women in English literature that, oh, this great novel written by a woman?
I mean, there were other great female novelists, not just Jane Austen, but the Brontes and Elizabeth Gaskell, and there were lots of great Victorian novelists. I think that the use of the masculine pseudonym kind of sets her apart, and she chose a pseudonym not simply because she was a woman, but because she was a notorious woman. She was living out of wedlock with a man that was extremely scandalous at the time, and so she wanted to hide her identity, but she also chose to hide her gender in order not to be dismissed as what she had called a silly female novelist. She wrote a famous essay called Silly Novels by Lady Novelists.
One of the great essay headlines of all time. And this novel, certainly, and her others, but certainly this one, is, I'm going to get hate mail, but less girly than Jane Austen's books, less so than the Brontes, isn't it?
It is. I mean, she's very much not a woman's writer or just writing about the concerns that we think of as only female, the novels that chart the progress of a young woman to marriage. I mean, she does chart the progress of young women to marriage, but...
And again.
Marriage and remarriage. But yes, she was taken as seriously as anybody was taken, and taken more seriously
right.
than most.
Reading it now as a book, do you ever feel, and you read it every few years, so you've read it many times, that this could stand some tightening and editing and revision now that it's a book, and go back and you could cut 50,000 words out of it?
Maybe if I were an editor, I would want to do that. As a writer, I just glory in the sentences and the language and the story, and I would not lose a word of it.
Right. It's just like more episodes of The Wire. Would that there were more episodes of The Wire or more chapters of Middlemarch. There's a passage in your book that I want you to read. It's the last two paragraphs on page 16, which are about the act of reading a novel such as Middlemarch.
Reading is sometimes thought of as a form of escapism, and it's a common turn of phrase to speak of getting lost in a book. But a book can also be where one finds oneself. And when a reader is grasped and held by a book, reading does not feel like an escape from life so much as it feels like an urgent, crucial dimension of life itself. There are books that seem to comprehend us just as much as we understand them, or even more. There are books that grow with the reader as the reader grows, like a graft to a tree. This kind of book becomes part of our own experience and part of our own endurance. It might lead us back to the library in midlife, looking for something that eluded us before.
That's Rebecca Mead reading from her book, My Life in Middlemarch. As you say, you read it first when you were 17. You read it again and again and again. Tell me about how it strikes you as differently as a 40-something-year-old than as a 17-year-old or a 28-year-old or a 36-year-old.
Well, when I was 17, I did think it was all about the struggles of aspiring youth because I was an aspiring youth. And when I read it in my 20s, I thought it was all about the problems of love and who to marry and whether to marry. Those were things I was thinking about, although I didn't get married until I was in my 30s. In my 30s, when I read it, I was very struck by the story of Tertius Lydgate, who's a doctor who aspires to do great things and ends up not doing so. And by that time, I was sort of into my professional career and hoping that the same would not be true of me. And by the time I was in my 40s, I read it in the light very much of my parents' marriage. There's a couple in Middlemarch, Fred Vincey and Mary Garth, who have been betrothed since childhood and marry one another. And when I was 17, I had absolutely no interest in them. They're sort of the boy and girl next door story, and it was so unglamorous and so unromantic. But reading it as an adult in middle age, I had the sort of dawning realization that this was my parents' story, that they had met when they were 15 and married at 21 and were married for 60 years. And so I came to look at that relationship in Middlemarch with such a different attitude and such an admiration for the idea of long-lived, enduring love.
Well, and that's sort of if the book has morals, and it does have a lot of morals. In fact, some people don't like it as much as, say, Jane Austen because it's enough already about telling me how to live. But it is that. It is that these small-looking lives can be unknown acts of heroism and great humanity.
Right. Well, that's the beautiful ending, the last lines of Middlemarch, where George Eliot talks about the power of lives that are not fully realized and that are not fulfilled on some grand scale, but that can have an impact on the lives of those people around them.
You talk about her relationships and her life in great detail in this book, which is interesting. There's a reticence in talking about your own life and loves and the details of you. Was that a strategy, or are you just a English person full of decorum?
My book is extremely personal. It's very much my story of my relationship with this book, and I don't think anybody else could have written it or would have wanted to. But it's not deeply confessional. It's true. It is not. I hope that I give enough and elide enough to satisfy and
I'm sure you will, all readers, but I've known you for a long time, so I was looking for the dirt, okay? I'm sorry. Have you ever had the thought of, God, I wish I could ask George Eliot X?
I do sometimes think that. If there were anything that I could be brave enough to ask her, and if she said, oh, ask me any personal question, it doesn't matter how personal, I would ask her about never having had children herself, because I'm the mother of an 8-year-old, and that's a very central experience, the central experience of my life. And I would be interested to know how she felt about never having done that, whether there was any difficulty in relinquishing it or whether it was something that came easily to her. But that's a very personal question. I'm not sure whether I'd even
dare. She'd slap you.
Yes, I don't know what she'd do. I'm not sure that I would dare.
Do you feel as though having spent so much time thinking about it, wrestling with it, that it will now, presuming you continue to read it every few years, it will have a different resonance or that you'll feel slaked?
I'm pretty sure I have not worn out my love for it in writing this book, and I'll be interested to see the ways in which it unfolds to me.
If you have worn it out, that would be an interesting piece, and you can come back on and talk about that. Rebecca Mead, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Kurt.
Rebecca Mead is the author of My Life in Middlemarch and a staff writer at The New Yorker. So, what do you all think? Is Middlemarch the great British novel that everybody has to read? If not, what is? Bleak House? Pride and Prejudice? Heart of Darkness? You can tell us online, or even better, call us at 646-580-0360. The phones are open, as they say. Tell us what novel you'd choose, and we'll get some of you on the show in the coming weeks. And don't forget about our listener challenge. If you can press record on your smartphone, you can enter our Scary Short Film Fest. Try your hand at making a 30-second scary movie. The deadline is March 2nd, and all the details are at studio360.org/scaryshorts. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Rose Connolly,
Eliza Martin,
Andres O'Hara Plotnick.
Our thanks to WNYC's Chris Bannon, and our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org. And by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, Art Works.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Beautiful, don't you think?
Next time in Studio 360...
What?
The sunrise.
Gravity is nominated for 10 Oscars and may become the first sci-fi best picture ever. I'll talk with director-writer Alfonso Cuarón next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.